I want to follow up on a number of issues that percolated here prior that I have some follow-up questions on. The two of you remind me of the old fiddler on the roof joke, right? He's right, how can they both be right? Well, you're also right. It's true, Mark, that there is a voluntary aspect to all communal life. You choose to live in a certain place. But what Dr. Sperber said is also true, that sociologically there is a reality to growing up in a community that you didn't choose. So if you're a child and you're 17 years old and you're living in a certain community and you feel that what rabbis have said to you completely violates your notion of the world, yes, it's true, in theory, you can leave that community. In practice, what are the political ramifications for rebelling against authority, both for the person involved and for their family? I don't think it's a simple matter, right? We've gotten to a situation where communities are not hermetically sealed in terms of geography. You can always move, and you can always meet other people, but somehow it still feels, and I think this is what Dr. Sperber was getting at, it still feels like if you rebel against a decision that's made, and sometimes the decision is made not even in response to a question that was asked, right? Which is what struck me about Rabbi Slifkin's situation. It wasn't like he went to people and said, tell me what you think of my books. So often the decisions are just made extemporaneously. So that's a problem that I have with what you're talking about. The other thing that I don't feel got dealt with here is, practically speaking, and my wife was speaking to me about this, is what do we say to these children? You know, Professor Kellner, you're talking about your brother with his 15 kids having a better shot at, religious grandchildren and great-grandchildren than you. So on some level, I'd still like to know, what do we say to the kids?
You're asking me?
Somebody. What do we say to the kids? Practically speaking, yeah, go ahead. What do we say to our children in their bind between authority that may seem not operative for them, not working properly, and their need to have respect for the borders of authority, because that's how religion operates?
If you're looking at, to me, you're obviously asking the wrong guy, because I chose to live my life not in Lakewood. I mean, I could have gone there also, right? So obviously I have certain values which to me are very important. But I'm aware of the cost that these values sometimes entail. It seems to me that, nothing brilliant at all, that young adults are not stupid. And young adults can handle ambiguity. And young adults can handle, at least in some cases, frank discussion where you will say a certain rabbinic authority is a wonderful person, is a deeply spiritual person, is someone you can admire on some levels, but you don't have to admire them on all levels. You can accept their authority in some areas. It doesn't mean that you have to accept their authority on all areas. Kids do that all the time. As they're growing up, as adolescents, they're doing that to their parents consistently and to their teachers. And I don't think that it's impossible. Again, there's a risk there. I don't deny it one bit. There's a real risk there, but I don't think it's an impossible situation.
Rabbi Slifkin, how old are your children now?
My eldest is 4.5. She's not yet struggling with the issue of rabbinical authority
right.
And doubts her so much.
But to tell you the truth, it won't be so long, right? In a few years, if she gets wind of what's happening with her father, what would you say to her?
Well, that was one reason why it would have been essential for me to have moved out of the Haredi community, just because it would have been... I mean, I had this situation where, choosing what school track I want to send my kids on, I couldn't put my kids in a school system, even in a Haredi school, which is more of an American-style school, where it's really just more like lip service to the notion of Gedolim Olam and Das Torah, but I can't put my kids in that educational track where they're in a system in which the figureheads are people who declared their father to be a heretic, because they're either going to grow up either resenting the figureheads, which is not good for their education, or thinking their father's a heretic, which I'm not so thrilled about either. So I'm going to have to do what Dr. Kellner suggested, which is saying that, yes, you know, respect those people for their accomplishments, for what they do as leaders of their community, but they're not leaders of our own community. And I think that's a basic educational message anyway, that there are different communities within the Jewish people, and we have to try to the best as possible, you know, understand those differences.
Let me just say, so these are trends, getting back to what Nachum said. If you went to 1920 and you said who has more attrition, the answer would be by far the Haredim, to be anachronistic. Poland, Jewish communities were falling apart, and Germany, German Orthodox, had very little attrition. So, I mean, these things come and go. Yes, today, there's no question that the Haredim have less attrition. But in 50 years, it could be very different. This has come and gone.
Dr. Shapiro, before, you've mentioned several times what is correct, a certain elitism in Maimonidean writing and a certain, you know, pronounced view that there are certain truths that are harmful to the faith of the masses if they're exposed to them. And Maimonides clearly feels that such teachings are true, but they would create havoc for the uninitiated. He talks about in the introduction to the guide, where he says that his treatise is intentionally meant for those who find themselves conflicted about this contradiction between the Torah versus the claim of reason. It seems to me that that idea opens on to a larger question. Because in your book, right, in Challenge of Creation, you comment on what seems almost parallel to Maimonides, which is the person that you're writing for is committed to Judaism but is disturbed by the challenges raised by modern science. And then you advise people in the opening of that book who do not possess a sufficient background in science or are not bothered by such questions not to read this book. I was also struck, and I'll just finish this point, by a third point that seemed parallel to me. As most people in this room know, in November of 2005, right after, frankly, I invited Rabbi Slifkin the first time around, Rav Shlomo Miller, who's the head of the Lakewood Kollel here, published a letter which condemned his work as having a reach minut, an aura of heresy. Now, what happened is that because of the internet, the letter was seen worldwide. However, a spokesman for the Rosh Kollel claimed that the letter was intended only for Rabbi Miller's followers and not for the general Jewish community, unquote. There's something that unites all three of these examples, right? Which is that I'm wondering about the larger fate of Judaism, where we are selectively protecting some people from some things and saying this is only for you and this is only for you, where rabbinic condemnations are meant only for certain ears and certain truths of Judaism are meant for only certain ears. So, frankly, I'm wondering, if you're a heretic, so shouldn't everyone know and be forewarned? What does it have to do with one person's community?
Because maybe he's not a heretic, as he pointed out. It's just that Rav Elyashiv is very Maimonidean. In his communities, these ideas would be very dangerous. They didn't put me in Cheirim. They're never going to do that. I'm not in their community. I'm not a threat. Someone who's in their community is a threat. And therefore, and he actually basically said as much when he met with, was it Rabbi Feldman, that it's not the ideas per se. It's the effect of the ideas in a certain context.
But heresy was never an effect.
He never said it's heresy.
Can I have to say something?
He never said it's heresy.
What do you have to say about this anyway?
Yeah, speaking of the local heretic, I'd like to just, you know, Dr. Spiro is correct in explaining Rav Elyashiv's position. Regarding with Shlomo Miller, who I was privileged to meet when I was here a few months ago, it was a very warm meeting, very pleasant tone to the meeting. I was also unclear about who the letter was meant for and so on, and what he explained to me, which is something that made sense to me, he says, you know, obviously he only expects his own followers to be following what he says, but he does sincerely believe that my books are heretical, and he'd certainly don't like it if other people would listen to that, because he sincerely does believe the books are heretical. So of course he'd like it if other people would listen to him, but he only expects that his own followers are going to be listening to him.
But you're not operating in the modern room in a locked room. Whatever you say is going to have ramifications all over the world. People are going to know that. You can't just seal it off and say, well, everybody's listening to this conversation, but I just want two of you to pay attention, right? So on some level, I can't follow the logic there.
Can I? There's something bizarre about this conversation. Not about these
people. It's one thing.
I guess it's like this. I'm personally offended when rabbis make determinations of heresy when they know nothing about the subject. And, you know, the Jewish tradition is 1,000 years of discussing the nature of heresy and the nature of Rambam's principles. And I'd be very surprised if any of the rabbis who declared that Rabbi Sifkin's writings are heretical or have an aura or a smell of heresy or are in the same neighborhood of heresy or in the same, I don't know, whatever, if they know anything at all about the subject. And I just find it bizarre that they're willing to make these pronouncements. If we asked them a question about kosher chicken, they wouldn't answer unless they knew all about the laws of kashrus. And that's one point. The second point is they based this entire discussion on Rambam. And for Rambam, you can't be a little bit heretical, and you can't be heretical for him and not for her. You know, it's bizarre. A heretic, in Rambam's eyes, it's a really serious thing. And if I for a moment believed that Natan Slifkin was a heretic and I wanted to fulfill Rambam's prescriptions, not only would I not be sitting here, I'd be trying to kill him. So, I repeat, it's bizarre.
Well, and again, the opponents of my work fall into two categories. There are those who sincerely believe that it is bona fide heresy, and there are those who, the majority, I would say, who don't really think that. But what they do think is that it's something very harmful for their communities, and even if they're not experts in theology, I do think they are entitled to make decisions as to the educational direction they want to take their communities in.
There's a third category, Moshe Sternbach and others, who believe the works are heresy, but you are not a heretic because they hold, in opposition to the Rambam, they hold that an unwitting heretic, Professor Kellner coined the phrase, a kofer b'shogeg, is not to be regarded as a heretic. So,
luckily for me.
I guess I'm interested, though, in the larger issue of does God intend the truth for some people, not for other people? Or to put it in Maimonidean language, is religion or life ultimately about simply maintaining correct beliefs, or is it about learning true opinions?
For Maimonides, for the intellectuals, it's about learning true opinions. For the masses, it's about maintaining correct beliefs. And for the Talmud, it's about neither of those. Right. It's about living a Jewish life, loving God and doing mitzvos, not atticism, as Shadal put it.
I think that's a very important point. The whole discussion of heresy derives from Rambam, at least the way it's been conducted for the last 800 years. I think Rambam was wrong. At least, you know, let me rephrase that in ways that are more politically correct. What Rambam did may have made a lot of sense in his day, but traditionally, what God wants of Jews is to inject holiness into their lives. And God tells us how to do it through Taryag Mitzvot. Before the Rambam, God never told us what to think. And I think that the question is a Maimonidean question, but that's a Chiddush in Judaism, that there are mitzvot be'emunah. Before the Rambam, there are none of them. And I think we'd be in better shape if we got back to the pre-Maimonidean stage.
I know that a number of you probably have questions, so I really don't want to spend much more my time asking questions. I'm just going to ask one last one and then throw it open to the floor. It sounds like here we're talking about modernity almost defined by autonomy, and I'm wondering if any of you here can envision a time where there would be a universal consensus on a central halachic authority. Again, well, obviously we have that institution in the Beit Din HaGadol 2,000 years ago, because many of you have been talking about different communities, different authorities for different communities. Well, is that sort of oxymoronic to talk about central authority in the modern world?
No.
No.
And it's a bad idea also.
No, there will not be a central authority.
There will never be, and it's a bad idea to even want it, because how can the West Side or this group have the same halakhic authority as the one in B'nai B'rak? As Dr. Skirber pointed out, you need to know the mitzios of the community. And a post-Sig in B'nai B'rak can't possibly know the mitzios of a grouping like this. So it's.
So I mean, but we did have a central authority, right?
When did we ever?
Well, we had a Sanhedrin at least.
Sanhedrin, 70 right. people arguing different points of view, so they could represent all different positions.
So you're looking at that 70 as
We've
all.
We've never had a pope, and we will never have one, and it's a very bad idea.
I think that the beauty of halakha is in its pluralism within a within certain parameters. I think that the fact that Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Elokim chayim, that there was a view of Beit Hillel and there was a view of Beit Shammai, and they were capable of living together even though they had different views, diametrically opposed views, is an example of the beauty of Judaism, of the richness of its the rich texture of its spirituality. And I think that Mitzur kelokeinu, mitzayar kelokeinu, she'en partzufehem donot, ve'en deyotehem donot. Who, the rabbi said that God is such a wonderful artist, a human being, a coin, makes a die for a coin, and all the coins come out exactly the same. God made a die for human beings, and each one is totally different. They look different, they think different, they act differently, they function differently, and that's why we're interesting. And that's the richness of life. And therefore, there cannot be a single unified opinion. And as I say, I agree 100% with Dr. Shapiro that this we should look for unity of aim and of purpose, but not of unity of practice.
I think that's the way it actually works out, even today. A good example of that is that on strictly Maimonidean grounds, Chabad is much more heretical than the Natanz Tzidkin ever will be. For the Rambam, not for me, okay? But nobody puts them beyond the pale, and correctly so.
Except for,
we know that, okay.
Except for.
A good friend of all of ours, but that's a separate issue. But the Jewish world works in that fashion. You know, if these rabbis who claim that Rabbi Slipkin is in some sense heretical were consistent, they would have to insist that Chabad was heretical. Once you start saying that the Rebbe shares Elokut with God, you're beyond any Maimonidean pale. But nobody does that, because we, as Rabbi Professor Shapiro pointed out, we're by our tradition urged and committed and hope to live together and to accomplish shared aims, and the most important of which is to live as Jews in the future and continue living as Jews in the future. And we can tolerate, I like to quote the Yiddish expression, von kasha starb man nicht, no one ever died from having a philosophical problem.
Okay, so I'm going to throw it up to the floor. Before I do, let's give these gentlemen a warm hand. If you wish to ask a question, if you don't, then I'll just keep asking, but if you wish to ask a question, so please approach the mic that's at the front of the room. I'm going to ask, as I always do, for two caveats. One is that you ask a question, you don't give a short speech, and the other one is that you direct your question to whoever you want to direct it to so that we can specify.
Well, I may make a short observation that they can respond to, not exactly a question. I know you were troubled, several of you were troubled about what would happen when rabbis make seemingly preposterous comments and do you destroy the authority of the rabbi or do you destroy the authority of Judaism and how do you answer the kids and things like that. Well, I think one of the things that you all agreed on was that rabbis are in fact not infallible, they are human. I don't see what would be wrong, for example, in pointing out that it's the nature of human beings to sometimes think they're a little bit too pompous. We have a good example that there was once upon a time in the medical profession, people used to think, well, doctors were next to gods. We don't think that anymore. We've come a little bit away from that. But people tend to feel that way. Could you not just say, this is just something which has gone to their heads? They're normal. They're only human.
Okay. I'm going to ask a doctor here. Remember a famous ex-judge of the Supreme Court in the United States saying, you get a case and you think of what decision you want to make and then you go ahead and try and justify it. Isn't that a little bit of what you were saying? when it comes to finding halacha for different people because of their circumstances.
I'd just like to raise the issue of what I think of as the quasi-sciences, sociology, for example. And it's easy for us to decide whether the earth is round or flat. That's a problem we can solve. But what about a question like, oh, say, nashim datehen kalot, women are light-minded. Is that a sociological issue? Is it capable of proof or disproof? And how should we react to input from sociologists on this question?
Talked about the expansion of Dat Torah to cover all kinds of areas where perhaps rabbis are not experts in, as well as the undermining of authority of the local rav versus the more internet or internationalist based rav based on publication. What about the Hasidic tradition that existed for hundreds of years about asking the Rebbe for everything concerning business decisions and any other circumstances? There's obviously a tradition in that regard that goes back many centuries prior to the modern times, and it continues to exist. That really hasn't changed, has it?
For those who are worried about Cherem, how do they deal with the fact that I think the Rambam's own books were at one time, so certainly the Ramchal and the Yaakov Emden.
Spinoza.
And also as far as rabbis making decisions, that, so let's say security decisions, that they're not fully aware of the, I think it started with the Chazon Ish, but it doesn't look like the politicians are doing such a good job themselves, so what the hell.
What distinguishes someone who is an expert in tradition, but critical of tradition, thinks about tradition, knows a tradition, versus someone who's just an authority? So there's a difference between authority and being thinking about tradition, critical of tradition. How do you distinguish the two?
Two quick questions. First is, what was the science in the Torah, I think, was the affair, or whatever that is? And the other was, you talked a lot about rabbinic decisions having influence on people, and you also talked about people being in various communities and I mean, how some people in some communities feel they're locked in. I guess the question that comes to mind for me is sociologically, or a person's in a situation and they the decisions of the rabbi can influence the community, and how far can that go to the acceptance of the individual? So I mean, this is I think the struggle that in essence you're dealing with, where people are in communities. I think some communities where people they have greater the rabbi has greater authority, or a smaller group of people have greater authority, and so. The influence of the rabbi, or the influence, it doesn't even have to be a rabbi. It could be, I mean, there are elements of establishment in our culture which have enormous influence. I mean, the media has incredible influence, and actually, you start to break it down, there are a few. So the question basically is, maybe you could discuss more fully how modern orthodoxy, I guess that's where we are, deals with the issue of the influence of rabbinic decision on individuals, and how that influences the community with respect to that individual. Thank you.
All right. The first question, can we just say rabbis are harmless? I mean, I guess we could say that.
seems to me that that just ties into the question I asked earlier, which is that if we make that determination, then there's a price to pay for making that determination, which is the undermining of authority, and you get back into that cycle. The second question, I think, probably was a misreading of what Dr. Sperber actually said. But in any case, I'll ask the question as it was asked. Aren't rabbis, haven't they already determined what psak is, and they're just looking for a justification in the sources for that psak?
It's a very important question, actually, and I think that you have to analyze the sponsor literature in order to understand how difficult questions are solved. Let me give you a classical sort of question. One of the most difficult questions facing rabbis throughout all generations was the question of the aguna, the woman whose husband had vanished. I'm not talking about the Masorevet Get, the present situation. Woman whose husband had vanished, and we didn't know, they didn't know whether he had died or not, and she was left enchained. Now, there is a principle in halakha that you should try to do all you can in order to free that woman from her enchainment. And that's a principle already found in the Talmud. And so when a rabbi is presented with a problem of this nature, and when he garners all the information, obviously his aim, his intention, his goal ideally would be to find a solution which would free that woman from her enchainment. Let's say we're talking about a period of 10 years that have gone by, and this woman is unable to get married, etc., etc. He will then plow through all the information, the material that's found in the literature, examine the various witnesses that might be available to give some sort of information, and he will be very happy if he is then able to come to a determination which will free that woman. However, on occasions, after going through all that process, he will find that he is unable to reach this conclusion. And when you read the responsa literature on this subject, you will see the pain with which they conclude that in this particular case they have not found a derech haheter, a way of solving this particular problem. So at times, a rav who is asked a question can say, I would like to reach this conclusion because of my compassion, because of my sensitivity, because I feel that this would be the best thing for this person. But he has to go through the mechanics of psak halakha based on the material that's available in the codes, in what I said was the wealth of halachic material, and in the rules and regulations of psak, the so-called klalei psak, and he will not necessarily come to the conclusion that he wants to, and he'll find that very tragic. And there are many, many tshuvot in which you feel the inner conflict and the inner turmoil of the posek in that he was not able to reach the conclusion that he wished to reach. So it's not a matter of, what they say, shooting the arrow and then turning and then painting the target around it. It's not that. An honest posek will aim in a certain direction according to his general halachic Weltanschauung, but he will not necessarily be able to reach that conclusion. And at times he will then consult with others who he feels are perhaps greater authorities to help him. And sometimes he will come to the solution that he wishes to, and sometimes he won't.
The next question, I guess, was dealing with certain pronouncements of Chazal that may be seen in a sociological light, for instance, Dat Nashim Kalot, and how the modern, I guess, would deal with that. I guess you're going to speak up a little bit about that tomorrow, but anyway, if you...
Me?
It doesn't have to be you.
Well, first of all, we have to know that there are a number of contradictory statements found in the Talmud. That they have a greater degree of understanding and perhaps intuitive understanding, which would seem somehow or other to contradict the notion of da'atan kalot. Maybe da'atan kalot means really that they're more intuitive and less cerebral, and therefore it's not necessarily a negative thing. So these types of statements have to be seen first of all in a general context of what other statements are said in the Talmud about women. Furthermore, one should know that there are many contradictory statements in the Talmud. The Talmud, after all, represents the sum total of opinions and knowledge of many hundreds of individuals living over a period of more than 500 years and living in different countries, in different political and geographic loci. So you can understand that there will be a variety of opinions on any given subject. And anybody who's read, for instance, the masterly work of Urbach, Emunot HaDeilot Shel Chazal, will see that there's a tremendous variety of views on all sorts of subjects. Now, undoubtedly, there were those authorities, Talmudic authorities, that had male chauvinist views of women, and there were some who, on the other hand, had extreme respect for women. And we can certainly understand the situation wherein, given the sociological status of women at that particular time, there may have been opinions which nowadays we find somewhat unpalatable. But these are certainly not opinions which are obligatory to us. We have to balance them against other opinions that exist in rabbinic literature and see which are more applicable to the present day.
I wanted to put together two questions. One of the people asked about the pompous rabbis, another about the nature of authority. Quasi-scientists called sociologists, who in my mind aren't even quasi-scientists, distinguish between being in authority and being an authority. Being in authority is like being a lieutenant in the army. The job defines you have certain authority over people of a lower rank, and that has nothing to do with you. You're given the rank and you have that kind of authority. Then there is a notion of being an authority where, by virtue of what you've learned or know, you have the authority to make determinations. You know a lot about a particular subject, and therefore you are an authority about it. Now, I know lots of great authorities in the academic world who are unbelievably pompous, and that in no way diminishes the authoritative character of what they say about Shakespeare, Rambam, biology, or whatever subject it is. I think one way of looking at everything we've talked about tonight is that many people make the mistake of thinking because a rabbi is an authority on halachic matters, that means they cannot be pompous. That's not true. There are great rabbis who are pompous. It means they cannot be immodest. That's not true. It means they cannot be short-tempered. That's not true. All these things are not true because rabbis are human beings. But they're also irrelevant to the question of how much they know and what they can teach you. It's to treat them as more than being authorities on the basis of what they know, but rather in a quasi-prophetic fashion, is, I think, the big mistake that, at least from my perspective, the big mistake many people make. Or let me rephrase it in terms more acceptable to my friend Mark Shapiro. If not a mistake many people make, it's a different way of approaching the whole question of rabbinic authority, and that is one of the ways in which distinguishes what people call the Haredi world from the rest of the world.
But I dare say no one would regard a pompous rabbi as a great sage. A rabbi has to be, as we heard earlier today, like an angel. So there certainly have been many great scholars who've been pompous, and that has, in many cases, prevented them from reaching, we all know of certain leading rabbis who asked, why didn't they get to the top? Why weren't they the Gedolim? And they were personal flaws. Usually, but not always, the great rabbis we know, the Gedolim, they had much less of these flaws. And
Ashrei Hama'amin.
I mean, he's making a good point, which is that, isn't it a little self-contradictory to say somebody, it's actually problematic, especially from what Dr. Sperber was saying before, to have somebody who is well-versed in halakha and short-tempered. I would dare say that would be a very problematic situation to go to this person for psak halakha if they have the tendency to get angry. Right,
right. So, but that's where Mark's point is true. People would stop going to them, but they would still not lose the technical authority granted to them by their knowledge. You know, if you could write to them, maybe, well, they wouldn't get angry at you.
But a posek is only a posek if people ask him questions. Otherwise, he's deciding for himself. People will stop going to rabbis who are only interested in creating machlokas, and there's a weeding out that the community doesn't always get it right. We've had examples of great rabbis who had personality flaws, serious personality flaws. But for the most part, the community does a good job. We pick the leaders, and we do a pretty good job in weeding out the bad apples.
I remain a lot less optimistic.
There's a famous New York Times interview with Moshe Feinstein where he said, they asked, you know, how did you become the great halakhic authority? He said, well, people started asking me questions, they liked what I had to say, and that's how it happened.
I find that not so simple. The Talmudic sources make it very clear that people with flawed character, and I don't know what sort of flawed character, should not be taken as halakhic authorities, even though they may have a tremendous amount of knowledge and wisdom. Let's take a simple example. If we know that a rabbi, a respected rabbi, has been defrauding the government of many millions of dollars, should, and I personally see that as a flaw in his character. I see that. I don't think that's the sort of thing that one should do, and I don't think it's a rabbi, besides the fact that it's a chilul Hashem. And he may be a very learned person. In this particular case, he may not be, but but he may be a very learned person. I would say that he's pasul lifsok halakha. He has not the right to give halachic determinations, in accordance with the Talmudic passage that tells us that people who have sheyatzu aleihem kol, that there were rumors that they had flawed characters, had no longer the right to teach and to give halakhic determination.
Thank you very much.
That's it.